So Patanjali first time comes to this definition of sporta as something very interesting. According to him, it's an impression of the sound in the mind. So sporta has this particular mental characteristic. So it's not that the sound we listen to this impression of articulation of meaning somewhere. The articulation of meaning can be in the unknown language also. But it is made in such a way that the whole setup, the whole context suggests certain meaning which we may read. The body language, the voice, articulation of the character, everything, the whole context suggests certain reading of meaning. And that would bring us to this theory of sporta of Bhartriyari. So we can start with our theory of sporta if you want, if you have nothing else to say for today. Now, here we are coming to the main concept, Bhartriyari. Bhartriyari is considered to be the most significant philosopher of language and linguistics from the beginning of Indic studies. From here we have some philosophical approach to language. And to illustrate that, I will show you the first shloka of Bhartrihari's Vakyapadiya, and we will see what Vartika says on it. But it is a little late. So, developing this thought of Patanjali, that sporta, the revelation of meaning, as we know, sporta literally means sudden opening. It's from root sput, to blossom, when the flower is opening, breaking. That is sporta. Disclosure. So, working on this particular research, what is this single entity or single meaningful unit as Patanjali defines it and how it works on the level of speech, he comes to the conclusion that actually it's not the word but the sentence in general is where the sporta takes place. It is Bhartrihari's contribution. He says that the word does not have any particular meaning to contribute much to the text because it can be used in particular context and mean even opposite to that what word means by itself. For example, I give you a very simple example. Somebody does something stupid in the classroom and teacher says, "Oh, how clever." Now, the word clever here means stupid, but it is out of context we know it. Yes, we do not know it otherwise. So the text, the word clever does not explain anything out of the text. It explains something within the text, an even wider setup in the context. There was a very interesting course in the university where I studied linguistics, and it was called Presumption of and Presuppositions in Text. So, for example, such examples, simple. The teacher comes to the classroom and says, "Don will go to Moscow." What does he say, really? Does he say that Don will go to Moscow? Or he says something more than that? He says many more things. You can feel it. You can't really immediately clarify what it means, but it means so many other things. It means that somebody else will not go to Moscow who supposed or was in the question to go. Because this decisive movement to come and to say Don will go to Moscow, it means that there was a question or debate or something before. And everybody is a part of it. You see, how many more things are to this meaning, which we cannot read immediately, this presupposition in the context. So Don will go to Moscow, if we localize this meaning, we will never get that sense, which Bhartrihari says, can be read only on the ground the whole world as it is has a meaning, from capital M, which can be grasped only as an indivisible unity. This meaning is inherent in the consciousness of man from his very birth. And here it's interesting to look into Chomsky.
I have a question here. Whenever
you're ready. Sure, we will come to this now. With which he later finds his partial correspondence in his language and reproduces it through articulation, and that is thought. So he will articulate certain contexts within certain bigger setups, yes, which are known to us prior to articulation. Otherwise, we would not come into, in terms of understanding. Communication will not take place. Yes, Rod. 1, 2, 3.
The example that you gave of Don Wondranowski probably did not exist at the moment of Don's birth.
Yes.
And so when it says this meaning, the meaning of the whole world, is inherent in the consciousness of man from his very birth as an indivisible unity, that seems to imply that what is there in consciousness is the meaning of the world as a whole. But the divisible parts of the world which make up that meaning, which unfold in time, are actually not known. I hope it does not imply that all of those things which unfold in time are pre-known. I think that would be a big mistake.
It's interesting how our consciousness works. I'm going to see how formulations are being made. Every statement is a statement partial due to time and space, yes? Every time it's only partial on the way understanding, yes? So what is being said here is only a part of some other part of some other part, and it is not the whole and can't be whole. Why? Because it is in time and space. And this is another contribution of Bhartrihari. He says, because of this flow in time and space of speech, it only partially articulates a bit of meaning where all the other bigger unity is presumed. And if it won't be presumed, that's why I mentioned this course of presumption in text. If it won't be presumed, we will never draw the meaning into the divisibility, into the division in which we all the time compare and draw meanings from. If that indivisible unity is not presumed, we can't communicate. It's an interesting view, it's a philosophical view, and we will see in the first statement of Bhartrihari, I will give you an example, we will read, Anadi Nidhanam Brahma, Shabda Tattvam Yadaksharam, what he says about this world, and what is this word doing to us, and how it is bringing divisibility. Though the world is indivisible, otherwise divisibility would not be possible. Divisibility, so to say, is possible only on the presumption of the unity and indivisibility of the whole existence. And all meanings related to each other into one bigger picture of meaning. I'm not sure I answer your question.
I just think it needs to be looked at.
Yes.
Otherwise some minds might think that it means that every detail is not at work.
You know, what I understand from that sentence, this meaning is inherent in the consciousness of man from his very birth. What I get is his ability to derive meaning from language and
from existence.
From existence.
Not from language yet.
Not that all of the sentences like Dr. Faust or whatever sentences, then there's an infinite variety of meaningful sentences and circumstances and situations that can arise. But our ability to derive meaning, to understand what is being said, that's inherent.
Yes. And that's what computer cannot learn. And last time when we were you remember this example with artificial intelligence, when the problem with artificial intelligence was that the more you explain to computer, more it asks questions. It wants to know everything. So you can't say anything to computer that a book is to read, and it asks what is to read. And you have to explain what is to read and what is man and what is to understand and everything. More you explain, more is left to be explained, because how we understand meaning, we do not derive meaning as computer does, by comparing divisions. We are not deriving meaning by comparing divisions. It's the mind's work. We are deriving meaning by this indivisible perception of existence. This is a fundamental notion. Once it is understood, it becomes very interesting, Hai, to see how other things work. So sphota literally means this sudden opening or disclosure which is taking place in both speaker and hearer. And notice this, not only in the speaker, but also in the hearer, the one who is listening, and not necessarily the one to whom you are talking, because you can speak to yourself, you can perceive your own speech. And that's why we have two. They are not kind of blocked. While you speak, you are not completely deaf to the sound of your voice, to the meaning of what you say. And basically what I want to say, that the most conscious speakers would be those would carefully listen to their own speech. If they can really separate these two functions while doing that, they will achieve certain ability of consciousness to perceive meanings.
Yeah, because what happens when you listen to your own voice while you're speaking is you enter into the present.
Right. This is one. Right. This is one thing, you enter into the present. Other thing is that you understand that what you say is not necessarily the product of only your mind, and that you have nothing to learn from this particular context in which the speech takes place. So speech becomes a power of inspiration for you. You become a poet. You open up yourself to the sources where this speech makes you understand. Of course, it's you who speak, but it is not fully you who speaks. Never fully you. But I don't want to go so far. It's in tantric. Yes.
I'd like to deconstruct that one sentence a little bit more.
All right.
The whole world as it is has a meaning.
Yes.
Capital M. Which can be grasped only as an indivisible unity. If that's true, then the meaning cannot be grasped in its incremental parts.
Well, it is not necessarily so,
yes,
because this is the mind
the
work.
Meaning, the meaning of the world, whatever the world means, for example, perhaps it means that it has meaning. It is something which has meaning. So the world as a whole has a meaning with a capital M, which is known when it's grasped as a whole.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Which means that everything has meaning, but only in relation to that totality.
Right. This is true. This is what text says and what Bhartrihari implies, that without that presumption, of the wholeness, of, we cannot really perceive the particular meanings. We can't. It's a nature of consciousness. So that's how we work differently from computers, which want to know by comparative what is what and how it relates. And more they expand their net of relations, more seemingly meaning is appearing there. But there is no meaning there.
These are,
yeah, only definitions. Definitions of definitions and distinctions of distinctions, which is not the meaning. Here would be interesting to come later to the reader's definition of the trace and how a mind works. But we will come maybe in the second part of our studies. We come back to this view of Bhartrihari again. So, the meaning is inherent in consciousness of man. That's from the very birth, and I'm happy to speak about this here, because Chomsky's idea would be very close to that, that the ability to perceive and to learn about the world is within the child's consciousness. It's not something which which you can teach. Yeah? It is something which you can learn. It's a kind of very particular subtleties there. Yeah? That we have this consciousness, only we have to learn how to articulate certain meanings and certain relations within this totality. And that's what is language about. So this spotta literally means, this disclosure, finally I come to this, both for hearer and speaker, through the process of articulation in both. Now, while I am articulating certain meaning, what is happening within your consciousness, you are re-articulating it. You are not listening to my only dhvani, to my voice, to the sound of my articulation as a rough. You are re-articulating those articulations of meaning which I am making within your own consciousness. And then you understand them. Or you don't understand. If my accent would be too terrible that you would not recognize English articulations, you would not be able to do that. Sometimes you have such terrible articulations, people from... Yes. Or if I start speaking to you in Russian, only few of you would be able to understand, because those articulations are not within your consciousness, within your grasp. So the sound of the speech, dvani, simply evokes this portal. So my sound, which is now as a wave vibrating, flying to your ear, registered by your brain with those articulations, what it does, it evokes in you articulation. And you, by re-articulating within yourself, get the meaning. Otherwise, you would not get it. So, there are several levels of this re-articulation. First is varna sphota, how I pronounce all the phonemes. Pada sphota, the re-articulation of the words. If the words are not cognized in the flows of the flow of the sentence, you would not be able also to figure out what it means. Then, vakya sphota, where is the meaningful one sentence, where it ends. Where, if it doesn't end, you would not be able to understand. Now, for example, I will tell you in such a way, like for instance...
You know, like that?
Yeah? You see, do you feel this hanging of the meaning? I didn't finish the sentence and you are questioning, what are you... And you are continuing in your consciousness going to say, how do you know how to continue? Who is continuing my unfinished vakya sphota?
In American English, it's quite common.
Yeah, well,
no one finishes their sentence.
Yes, so this, these parasites, yes, you know.
I just realized that with the class of 6 and 7 year olds that I have, when I introduce them to the idea of a sentence, of course it's defined as a group of words that makes complete sense. And then I give examples of half sentences. I will begin a sentence and say the object or the subject, and then I'll say, okay, so do you understand? I'll say, Vladimir, last night, and they all look at me like, last night what? And I say, okay, is that a sentence? No, it isn't. Unless I finish saying, or I say, Johnny, across the street. But it drives the point home to them that unless it makes complete sense to them, the whole group has meaning, that it's not a sentence. But I'm just starting to see that that sentence is very significant in deriving the entire meaning of language.
Can you imagine that this is the information which is most valuable for us, that within the child there is a drive to the completeness in the sentence. And this is what Bhartrihari proposes. He says there is no meaning without sentence being complete. If there is no dot at the end, it's not yet there. You have to wait for that dot. You are not sure fully what it means until that dot falls. And then only you can reconstruct, recollect, rearticulate within yourself, see within the context. But before that is done, it's not yet there. It's a very, very... So this drive in the child to have a complete, finished sentence is something we have from our birth. It's a nature of our consciousness. So the sound evokes the supporta in the hearer as varna, pada and vakya supporta, or we can call it as morpheme, phoneme, morpheme, articulation, cognition, because articulation, cognition here will be on the same level. The word articulation, cognition, the text articulation, cognition, respectively, yes? These three. The differentiation between sound and articulation is one of the fundamental features of the theory of supporta. Supporta is not a sound we hear, but the sound we articulate. So according to Bhartrihari, supporta operates within universal sounds, whereas dhvani, that outer sound of our speech, within a particular sound. My apparatus, my ability to articulate, my particular cultural background, where I am from, and so on and so forth. This is a particular sound. But articulation of sound will be universal, the same as you have. There will be no difference. The opposition between supporta and dvani is also presented as an opposition of class to individual. In modern terms, supporta can be understood as having constant distinctive phonetic features. Now, what is phonema? Phoneme is that which is coined in the mind. And phonic nature is that which is sounding as a loudspeaker. Loudspeaker can be of different qualities. The amplifier can be of different quality, but the articulator of the sound in the mind will be of the same. Phonema, phoneme A will have everywhere A quality. It won't be different. But you can pronounce it in many different ways. Supporta is that which is to be manifested, vyangya, and the dvani is manifesting, vyanjaka. Supporta is not uttered, but it is perceived by the ear. And this is an interesting thing, why I'm saying all this to Rod, that maybe it's not by the sound that the poetry is perceived, but by that subtle impression in the mind of that weight of sound, of that meter which is there, which creates in the mind understanding. Because Otherwise, people may hear poetry, but it may not touch them, because they have not this ability, subtle ability, to perceive it. This spotter does not touch them. So it's a certain ability to be a poet, to perceive it, to really enjoy poetry. It's not for everyone. Well, maybe it's too far-fetching definition. So to make the distinction clear, Bhartrihari introduces two types of dvani, two types of sounds: prakrita dvani, natural sound, and vikrita dvani, that which is distorted, uttered sound, where spota is revealed through the former only. So the spota is revealed through prakrita dvani, which is never uttered, never heard by the hearer, but uttered within his consciousness. So the secondary vikrita sounds, those which we hear, as computer hears, and I was giving you the example when I learned English with computer. Whatever I said, computer didn't recognize the word. Yes? A chair, 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 chair. Everything, every way, computer couldn't read my chair. My chair was some kind of Russian chair. I want to say that this is exactly where this dvani works, vikrita dvani, yes? Because computer does not have spota, cannot reconstruct and rearticulate, it will read this dvani. And if dvani is not matching with that signal, it will not catch it. So on semantic level, yes, what I want to say, secondary vikrita sounds are only to indicate primary ones, which computer doesn't have, but we have. And thus to kindle up this porta with which it, with the help of pratibha. Now I am introducing another term. Pratibha is the flash or the insight of intuition. This is how porta works. This flash is suddenly you say, aha, I got it. I got what you mean. Whether I got it or not, it depends. Maybe I got it in my context.
But isn't that...
Yes, and we are right. Triple price.
Isn't that sound?
Yes.
That I got it also present in the Prakrita Dvani?
It is only in Prakrita Dvani, not in Vaikrita.
So it's not only in what is heard, it's also in what is spoken.
That's what I'm saying. I'm saying that all this porta is in Prakrita Dvani alone, and not in Vaikrita. Vaikrita only communicates, it evokes, it provokes porta.
So this is what Sri Aurobindo maybe calls the soul of the word.
Yes, maybe. Yes. Or the poetry, or that particular poetic rhythm. Yes, later spota is taken in much wider sense as a creative power of the word. But still here we are dealing in linguistic terms. So on semantic level, as it was developed by later grammarians, spota makes the text correspond with the universal text totality, Shabda Brahman, and therefore the text can be easily understood as such. It's later, it's a philosophy of language. And once the inner perception, pratibha, of the hearer flashes out, reflecting something of that totality, the spota, the revelation of the meaning of the text, takes place in his consciousness. It has to have this correspondence with text totality. And if it doesn't, we would not be able to understand each other. Can you imagine how many meanings we imply when we say something simple, like Don will go to Moscow? How many meanings are there? It's the whole cosmos of meanings. And if it is not there, the meaning of Don will go to Moscow will not be understood. He is already in Moscow.
You could say Don will not go to Moscow.
Will not go to
It has many more meanings.
My father used to say when he was working on his, he was a linguist and a historian, he was working on texts of 12th century, Slavic texts. And he used to say to my mother, "But Helene, I am in the 12th century. Let me be, you know." It was something of the kind. It's a faraway space and meaningful space. It has its own meaningful world. The text totality is there also recreated. So if you have some questions up to now, it's a time before we move into overview of the whole supporter theory. Does it make sense a little? Yeah?
These sounds which are basically not part of Sanskrit, like the or the, would they then belong to unnatural sounds?
Squarely put question. Well, I must then look into Sanskrit alphabet to show why and how and what it is, because Z, and first of all, there are all sounds in Sanskrit, that there is no Z, there are no voiced fricatives. Now you have Ha, Sha, Sha, Sa, Fa, all of them you have. For example, Balakaf, Phalam, Grahnati. Balakaf, Patati. F will appear before P. There is such fricative as F. But there is no fricative, there are no voiced fricatives, as you say. There is no Z, Z, R, V.
With
the
vowel inside.
Yeah, voiced. That's what is Z and Z. Z and Z is our voiced fricatives. But we have Ha, Sha, Sha, Sa, Fa. We don't have Ra, Ja, Ja, Za, Va. Some languages have that. Why we don't have them? In Sanskrit, it's an interesting question. Because we have already, on all these five levels of articulation, which are only five. It's interesting, yeah? There are back tongue, there are palatals, there are cerebrals, dentals, and labials. And there is nowhere else you can put your tongue to articulate something else. Of course, you can distort. There are allophones. But as a pure articulatory devices, you can touch, with aspiration, you can touch with voice, and aspiration, you can direct through nasal cave that thing. Yes, nasals. Ma nya na ma ma, yes, ma nya na na ma. Or you can make what? Semi-vowels, you can make vowels, a, e, ri, li, u. You can make semi-vowels, ha, ya, ra, la, va. You can make fricatives, ha, sha, sha, sa, fa. And you can make voiced fricatives. And your question is, why there are no voiced fricatives? So I kind of localize your question, fine. There are no these voiced fricatives because there are already ja sounds. Ja is touched voiced, yes? So if you have ja, why to have ja? Ja, ja, you have John and John. This is the different reading of the same sound. You make it voiced fricative in French, whereas in English it will be touched fricative, not fricative, but touched voiced. I think there is somewhere there answer can be found. That je and John and Jean, why they are not the same, two sounds, why you don't have je in French and why in English they don't have je. They prefer to have one sound. That may be the leading direction of research. Otherwise, of course, you can introduce voiced fricatives. And other languages have them. Z, for example, would be a very useful sound, but we don't have it in a Sanskrit language.
Yeah, what's amazing is that it's a very
common,
common sound in most languages. So it's actually amazing that it's not there in Sanskrit.
Germans would have other versions about it. Very interesting, because in their language, the voiceless fricatives or voiceless consonants will be voiced in an intervocal position or before vowel, like dizona and disona, but d because e and o, and it is in between two vowels, it will become z, dizona. Also, it's s sound. Maybe that was also the way or the direction of thinking why these fricative voiced did not appear as separate sporta varna. Because now we are speaking about varna sporta, those articulations in the mind. Then later they have allophones, all kind of byproducts. Because all kinds of byproducts, you can distort sounds. You know, you can make from many different ways of sounding it, but in the mind it stays still.
But none of the Indian vernacular languages have those sounds that you see lacking in Sanskrit. None of the Indian vernacular languages.
It's interesting.
So it's a whole country.
Yeah, but they introduced from Persian. No, they have Z with dot underneath. They introduced from Persian the zaruri hai.
Yeah,
you can't
escape. From Urdu.
Yes, from Urdu or from Persian. Yes, and all these other khush hai, the dot underneath and so on. But they had to introduce them from somewhere else. So we continue. So the spota can be seen as a communication device based on recognition of the truth of existence through the word text, text in general, bigger text, in hearer speaker, satta. That's what he is using. He is using this term satta, existence. It is on the ground of existence that we recognize meanings, and not on the ground of language. And a very subtle, very interesting definition. It is therefore of a psychological nature, as any human speech is, for the recognition of the meaning of the text is perceived by consciousness, which lies beyond the analytical capacity of the external mind, and carries in itself all meanings, and as such its proper understanding requires a psychological experience.
Who's the author of this?
It's me. It has to be a little bit better made, as I see it now. In your hearing, it's another very interesting part of sporta. When I introduce you into my hearing device, yes, you different sporta articulators. I introduce you into my sporta articulation. I see things differently. We are building up one particular sporta screen on which I perceive my own speech and thinking differently. That's the beauty of these gatherings, that we can share together different ways of thinking. Even today, that's why I see many things immediately. I even have to reread them. It's just a mistake, a few mistakes here. Ease has to be moved and so on. Even today, this theory is widely recognized, and that is the beginning of studies. St. Petersburg University in Russia took the whole project on Bhartrihari, and all linguistic studies are turned towards Bhartrihari more and more, because it's profound, it's dense with meaning. Now, I want to move into the general observation of what is this theory of spota. This is now will be 8 different definitions. The general overview of the concepts. Today we have to finish it because next time we will move into tantric, into the tantra. So the general overview of the concepts of spota. There are 8 major approaches to the theory of spota. There is varna spota, that the articulation recognition takes place already on the level of articulating sound. But not sound as dvani, but sound as sphota, as prakrita dvani, yes? As mentally coined varnas. Because varna is not sound which sounds outside, but varna is sound which is articulated within the mind. Padaspota, the articulation of the word. Every word has a morphological accent, as we saw in previous lecture, which is recognized as such, separately by this accent. Vakyaspota, when the child is waiting till the end of the sentence and cannot understand it, and we cannot understand the sentence until it is finished. There are also other few definitions. Akhanda padaspota, it is for the synthetic languages. Undivided meaning of the word. For example, balakasya, of the child. Balakasya is the meaningful word, cannot be divided. This is akhanda, undivided word. Or it can be divided. Balaka is one meaning and balakasya is another meaning. So grammatically, the genitive case can be separated from the noun. But in akhanda padaspota theory, they are not separating these two, grammatical meaning and the meaning of the word. Akhanda vakyaspota, also the vakyaspota theory, the sentence as such is understood as undivided meaningful unit and can be applied into any context. Varna jati spota. Now we are moving into interesting definition. Jati is that which is inherent, which is universally applied. So we are recognizing, as we were just saying before, the meaning of the sound through those mentally coined jati sounds. We are not recognizing them through the manners of articulation only. We are recognizing them through jati, but also through the manners. For example, somebody from Texas or Alabama, as it was mentioned before, can have a particular way of articulating which will add to the meaning that he is coming from that place and carrying within him all those significances of that place. And it makes sense what he says because of that place. So, not only varna jati spota is possible, but also as a universal meaning, articulations of a as a, but also a as a, which adds to that meaning, particular meaning. Pada jati spota is the same, that every pada has some universal meaning. Like for example, gotvam is used, yeah? Cowness in the cow. It is by that cowness in the cow that we know that cow is cow, and not by the cow as a cow. Yeah. You see the cow and you will not recognize it as such, unless you will have that notion of cowness. And we were trying in the philosophy of evolution to recognize who is who. You remember? That's what we were looking for. We were looking for cowness, for the cows, and for catness in the cat. And vakya jati spota is also a definition that every particular sentence has a universally available meaning. It's a very far-fetching definition. But what I'm trying to tell you, I'm just showing you all possible ways of looking at it, and I want to tell you that all of them are valid on their own level. If you add one to another, you will have more and more holistic view on sport. they are quarreling among each other, and we will see more definitions now, and you will see why they are kind of this. There will be about distinction of definitions rather, no more than that. Varnasporta is defined as a denotative vachaka when a single phoneme or a stem or affix is found to be so, and therefore the varnasporta is taking place. It's a very strange definition. But I will tell you like this. For example, when I speak to you and suddenly I say the cow ness, I said the cow and then I change it to ness. Yeah? When I make this change within my flow and I add to it certain particularity of morpheme or affix or suffix or one phoneme which makes sense, I'm utilizing this varnasporta. I'm changing the meaning by changing the sound. If I'm doing that, then varnasporta is taking place. It's not that every sound has meaning as such only, but also when I articulate it in a particular way to make the meaning, yeah, as we were Alabama doing, that was varnasporta definition. It wasn't anything else.
It's not Alabama.
Okay, I'm sorry. How is that?
Alabama.
Exactly. And they have also very particular breathing.
Classroom.
When I heard this classroom, it took time for me to really to translate for myself, to re-articulate. Yeah, it's quite interesting. So, but in a theory, this theory utilizes the analysis from bottom to top when we take it in a pure grammatical sense, which is mainly found in grammatical treatises such as Panini, descriptive grammar. So he starts with affixes, he starts with alphabet, and he grows into morphemes and so on. Varnasporta has its difficulties in the immediate application to the analysis of the word, especially when the systematic forms, synthetic forms of the word are examined, such as, for example, ghatena, with the port, yeah? For it cannot clearly define them into separate and meaningful units. Where is the affix, where is suffix, where is root? In synthetic languages, but not in analytical languages.
Like in English, if you had the word girl, and then you added girls, it would change the meaning to more than one.
Yes.
And it's easy to separate that from the girl.
Or any other, to this school, yes? If I say vidyalayam in Sanskrit, to this school, it doesn't say, it's very difficult to define where that definition of directness is, yes? Well, for Russian language it's the same. But for Hindi,
When the question was asked about natural sound and unnatural sound, maybe the question was not about natural or unnatural, but natural or synthetic. Or natural sound or artificial, constructed sound.
No, when I bring this meaning, I articulate Alabama accent for you, then I utilize varnasporta. When Alabama person speaks, he doesn't do that. Yes. This what you mean?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, when I meaningfully do that, to bring some other meaning which I cannot bring otherwise, but only through the varna, through the sound, then that would be varnasporta.
Explain why in certain languages, like in English, you would say some particular words
that carry particular meanings in French, for example, déjà vu.
Right.
There is no translation in English right. of the concept of déjà vu.
Yes.
So you have to say it in French.
It's an interesting notion of also, yes, borrowing words from other languages. Shubindu has very rich vocabulary, and in Savitri you can meet even Russian words, by the way. So, yes, such words like ukaz. Do you know what is ukaz?
Yes.
Nobody knows what ukaz is in English, I'm sure.
It's used in English.
It's used in English.
It's in the UK.
Yes.
UK.
For instance, Israel was founded by a ukaz from the
right.
UN.
But it must have an earlier root.
Right.
Should look into Sanskrit.
Yes, it is. It is ukbak. Yes? Указывать, казать, then later, but uk is the major root from which we have in Russian language, учить, учитель, and also уктриани, глаголи мои брахмани, островицы мяса не едяши, it's from...
It must have a Latin form.
Yes. But it is interesting that my father wrote the whole article on this. There was a mentioning of уктриани, уктриани, уктар, уктри, вактар. They speak the word, glagolimaya brahmani, they call themselves brahmanas, and it is from Tatishchev letopis, which is the 17th century. Nobody heard about them, of brahmanas at that time. But what is interesting that these Uktriani, they lived in the north of Germany, in north of Poland and Germany, where Prussia was, and there was a Rügen, there, maybe some of you know even, the island Rügen, where they lived and where they are coming from. And they were Uktriani, they called themselves Brahmanas, they didn't eat meat, they had only honey, and they offered with honey and flowers to the gods. And they called themselves Uktriani. This is and it's very interesting because Slovyani, in general, Slovyani is those who carry the word. And I think that was the translation of all those tribes. Because when Kazimir, the hetman of Poland, came to Russia and he asked them, who are you people? They said, we are Russians. No, we are Slav, Slovyani. But whose are you? Yeah, they said, we are Russians. And it seems that Rus, it was the tribe of Scandinavia, and the first king, Rurik, was coming from Scandinavia, from Nordic bloods, from the north. And they were invited to rule, and the whole country took the name of Russian as an adjective, ruled by Rus. So they belonged to Russian ruling, but they are themselves Slovyani. They were making this distinction in 17th century. Later it was lost completely. Never had any distinction. It's just for you to think how things... Because Uktriani, Vaktar, and here exactly Ukaz is for the same root. Vach, speech, to speak. So Padasporta maintains that the finished word... maintains that the Finnish word, oh, it's a mistake, not as, but is a unique entity which conveys the meaning. And the division into the morphological components, into suffixes, stems, and so on and so forth, does not occur when the speaker or listener understands the speech. Now, when we listen to the word, especially in synthetic language, if I say balaka sya, you don't hear balaka and sya, you hear balaka sya of the child. Yes, this theory claims that the text can be described by listening to the words and their meanings, as well as by perceiving the relation between them in the synthetic structure of the sentence. So by listening balakasya griham asti, you can collect the meaning and make it one. This is the theory of padaspota. So balakasya is already enough. Of the child is already meaningful unit, but it requires continuation, yes? So I can continue and build up on it, and build up on it until I finish the sentence. It is by listening to the meaning of every word and linking it with another word that the meaning of the sentence can be understood. But since the meaning of the sentence is the final meaning, which is to be understood, then the padaspada theory is found insufficient in the description of perception of meaning and leads to the next level of synthesis, vakyaspada. Now, Bhartrihari speaks only of vakyaspada. And that's why his treatise is called Vakyapadiya. It's interesting, he puts vakya first, sentence, word. So the sentence is first and the word is second. Vakyaspota maintains that the sentence is a unique entity which conveys the meaning. The sentence in itself is a unit of meaning. Vakyaspota, however, does not claim that the constituents of the sentence do not have meaning. The main point of this theory is that the word should be always seen and understood in the context. The words have their meaning only when they form a part of sentence. And it makes sense. The child does not have meaning if it is out of the sentence. It is in the sentence that the child will take its meaning, what it does and what happens to it.
I mean, that's where poetry is very interesting, because in terms of poetry, you can put the word child on its own and you all feel this great meaning.
Yes.
We accept it as a sentence.
Yes. Sometimes it is so complex in poetry that you can't really understand it until you come till the end, yes? Because the placement of parts are unusual in a way, and you cannot really fully grasp until it ends. And there are sometimes very long sentences in Sri Aurobindo's Savitri. And at the end only you get it, that all that belonged to that particular statement at the end. For example, in syntax of... it's all about syntax we are talking now. Yeah? In syntax of German language, it's very interesting that, for example, in German language you can say everything for so long, the whole speech, and at the end you say, nicht. And everything what you were saying means it's not that. It's just opposite to that. So until you hear that nicht, you can't be sure what it is all about. You are a great speaker, a great conqueror of the worlds. Nicht. Okay, not a great speaker.
In Japanese, the verb comes at the end of the sentence.
Exactly. And it is very close to this agglutinative type. It's very interesting. In elay, in a tunnel. Now, you can do the same thing. You can say many things, and at the end, elay means everything opposite to that, what you were saying.
In Tokyo also, the verb comes usually at the end of the sentence. And the verse is a big problem that we have as English speakers communicating with Tamil speakers.
Yeah.
They really have to turn it around before it means anything.
Right. It's interesting.
Translators at the United Nations and so forth are said to have the problem.
Yes. Translators in the United Nations have troubles. If they have troubles, then...
No, just in that one aspect. What is the verb of the sentence finally?
Yeah, because they're doing simultaneous.
Yeah, simultaneous.
Yes, and it's also interesting because in the Semitic languages, if you take Hebrew, for example, the verb has a tendency to be at the beginning of the sentence. if you read the Bible, at least in biblical language, not in the modern maybe, Hebrew, so all the translations of Bible into English were made in such a way that you get another English. You have always these verbs at the beginning, and it became a biblical English, so to say, which is a kind of distorting English, an English way of speaking.
This, for instance, is happening in the European Parliament. Each document has to be translated in the mother language of minimum 15. So the documents are mostly unreadable. You cannot understand. So we send people to the European Parliament, and they translate the text that has been put in this language. So we pay translators on translators. And, you know, it becomes even more not understandable.
I mean, in English you call that Chinese whispers.
Whispers.
Where one person says the next
one. Right, right.
At the end it's
telephone. Spoiled telephone. Yeah. Yes, because what I have read, for example, Chinese translation of Pushkin into Chinese and back from Chinese to Russian. Believe me, there was nothing of the kind. Pushkin never said anything of the kind. It was another text altogether about other subjects. It's quite interesting because the meaningful stresses, what they made, they read it differently. And then they put it differently. And then it was translated back. And it didn't resemble the poetry of Pushkin. So there is this Akhanda Padaspratha, which maintains that the word is perceived as undivided, single, meaningful, bearing unit. You know? Meaning-bearing unit, it's a long word. Undivided, single, meaning-bearing unit. This is the composita which I made in, not very legal, but sometimes in English you can make such long words, you know? $64,000 question or something. This is $64,000 question is one word, where question bears one accent, and $64 million does not have accent at all, because it's a composite. $64 million question. So here is the same thing, compositor, which is undivided single meaning bearing unit. So it is not perceived by its parts, suffixes, stems, but a single and undivided meaningful unit. We just now saw it. Akhanda Vakya Sphota says that it is insufficient to perceive the separate word, for in ordinary communications the sentence as the whole is perceived as a meaningful and not a separate word. Bhartrihari thinks that such division of the sentence into words and stems, etc., does not exist in the ordinary perception of speech. This is quite normal. We are not listening to the words. We are listening to the meaning. That's why children cannot say what you say, because they didn't get it yet, what you want to say. Because what we want to say will be the meaning. In common use of speech, the meaning is taken as a whole, including the context. It is only when the utterance is made that the speaker can dwell on it and analyze it in parts and words, stems and etc. So, but not when he is speaking. It's an interesting thing also. If you want to meaningfully speak, you cannot analyze your speech and speak at the same time. You will have to be driven by something which is meaning-driven spirit, and whatever mistakes you make in this particular drive will be forgiven you by the listener because you are driven by the meaningful drive. I make millions of mistakes in English. all the time. But because I am driven by meaningful spirit, you understand me. And you reconstruct it in your articulation. Knowing that, I am allowing myself to do that. If I would not know that, I would be stuck to that particular problem that I can't speak pure English, and I would be absolutely devastated at every turn that I can't communicate. But communication is not in proper grammatical structure of the word or the sentence. It is somewhere else, using that grammatical structure. So I am using myself as an example. And if he is able to grasp the parts of speech while speaking, such as syllables, he will lose the meaning of it all. That's Bhartrihara's definition. If I will start really listening to my syllabic or articulation and so on and so forth, I am deviating from the meaningful drive. I am becoming artificially articulating something which is not there anymore. According to this theory, the Varna and Padas Pota describe language in its functions, not in its use. So Vyakti Spota and Jati Spota, I'm not sure about timings. Oh, we are at the end, yeah? 15. So maybe I will finish it next time, and we will move into, it will be a good link for us to make a link. I wanted to finish today this particular section, but I couldn't somehow, because of many different examples. We have 5 minutes, then I will finish. To answer the question whether Spota is particular or universal, there are two different theories, or two different approaches. Vyakti Spotavada and Jati Spotavada. The Jati Spotavada maintains that non-difference in the varied individual elements is generic, while Vyakti Spotavada says that the difference is associative. I will explain. The Jati Spotavada, for the Jati Spotavada, the meaning-bearing word is the class, cowness. It is through the cowness that we know the cow is cow, which is revealed by individual instances. We see the cow and we relate to cowness. The individuals are not meaning-bearers. They are simply indicators of that universal meaning. This is jati. But vyakti says something else. Vyakti emphasizes that actually it's not fully like that. That this particular cow, individual cow, with this black and white spots, you know, and with this particular beautiful horns, already contributes a lot to meaning. More than only cowness. It's not only from the cowness that we draw the meaning of this cow, but from many other particularities which cow bears. Both are valid and complementary. There was one more distinction important to mention here, which formulated the two different approaches to the understanding of Spota. And here it's interesting, just look at this. Abhihita Anvaya Vada. Abhihita Anvayavada and Anvita Abhidhanavada. Just replacement of two words. So Abhihita Anvaya, it is stated first by the words and followed then in the sentence, if I translate it literally. Through the words we complete the sentence. And the other one is opposite, following after the statement. The statement is made as an intention, It's clear, and from intention the construction of the words is taking place. But both are valid. It depends on your priority in your mind, how you would like, how you work, this or that time. So all these theories of Spota, with many other variations and commentaries, make a rich layout for the linguistic studies of meaning in the terms of structural semantics, and together represent a holistic view in defining all possible approaches to meaning within the grammatical structure, morphology and syntax. Now, I'm not saying that this is a meaning, I'm saying it's a rich layout in morphological and syntactic structures. We will see what meaning is later. Spota is a disclosure of meaning, but it is not meaning. So, that's enough for today, and we will have a tea and cookie. Thank you very much.
Thank you.